Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Hamish Johnston, and today I'm joined by my colleagues Tammy Freeman, Mateen Durrani, and Tushna Commissariat. Much of today's podcast is devoted to the Nobel Prize for Physics, which will be awarded next week, on Tuesday, I believe. And in particular, we're going to be talking about what it's like to be part of the committee that chooses prize winners. And we're also going to find out what it's like to get a telephone call from someone with a Swedish accent who tells you that you will soon be making the trip to Stockholm. But first, Tammy is here to chat about how a low-cost and non-invasive optical technique could help doctors assess blood flow in the brains of children with sickle cell disease. Now, this is a very painful and very dangerous inherited disease of the blood that affects about 4 million people worldwide. And I think in the UK alone, it affects up to 15,000 people. So hi, Tammy. Why are doctors treating sickle cell disease in children keen on measuring blood flow?
Okay, so in sickle cell disease, instead of having round red blood cells, the patients produce red blood cells that are shaped like sickles or like crescent moons. Now, these irregular shaped cells can get stuck in small blood vessels, and this can slow or block blood flow and oxygen delivery. Now, one of the symptoms is that it can have major impacts on the brain. For example, by the age of 15, about 2% of children with sickle cell disease have had a stroke with neurological symptoms.
Wow, that's incredible. You don't think of children having strokes,
no.
Do you? That's terrible.
And in addition to that, about 40% will have had what's called a silent stroke, where there's no obvious symptoms. But these silent strokes accumulate, and they're also associated with cognitive impairment and an increased risk of an actual stroke. Now, the mechanisms underlying this aren't completely understood, but it's believed to arise from anemia, so where there aren't enough healthy red blood cells to carry enough oxygen to the body's tissues, combined with that abnormal blood flow due to factors like narrowing or blocking of blood vessels, or increased blood viscosity, and even the blood cells sticking to the insides of the vessels. So a way to measure abnormal blood flow in the brain could allow doctors to give timely treatment and reduce the risk of stroke.
And this technique is called diffuse correlation spectroscopy. And, you know, to me, it sounds like a bit of magic. I shouldn't be saying that because I'm a scientist and there's no such thing as magic.
Absolutely.
But it seems like you shine light onto the skin, and then you detect light that is bouncing off moving blood cells and sort of work out how fast they're going. Is that how it works?
Yeah, pretty much. So in diffuse correlation spectroscopy, the tissue's illuminated with near-infrared laser light, and the reflected light is detected at the tissue surface using a remotely located detector. And the idea is that you measure changes in reflected light intensity over time. And these changes are mainly caused by the motion of the red blood cells. So in this study, the researchers used an 852 nanometer laser and a fiber optic sensor, both secured on the patient's forehead. They looked at two different source detector separations, so separated by 1 centimetre, which makes it sensitive to tissue on the outside, such as the scalp and the skull, or separated by 2.5 centimetres, and this also measures right into the brain tissue in these children being studied. Each measurement took about 2 minutes, gave 40 to 50 results. And then what the researchers did was they created a function that relates these intensity fluctuations to the flow of red blood cells and used this to create the average, to work out the average flow of blood cells in the tissue being examined.
I'm always amazed at you know, these diffuse optical technologies that, you know, very cleverly allow you to, you know, sort of see through tissue or see through clouds, or even I think in some cases you can actually use these technologies to see around corners.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, not only can you see through a diffuse medium, you can also use it to see around a corner, which is you know, I find that really amazing. So what's next? Is this going to be developed into a clinical technique that doctors can actually use and children can benefit from?
Yes. So the team they're carrying on with their benchtop experiments in phantoms. So, for example, they're investigating how the ratio of the volume of red blood cells to the total volume of blood, which is something that varies a lot in sickle cell patients, how that might impact the spectroscopy measurements. They're also trying to develop ways to reduce manufacturing costs, make the system wearable and wireless. And yes, they have several prospective clinical studies planned, looking into whether these measurements of brain blood flow could actually help in clinical decision making.
Oh, that's great. Well, I hope this is a success for the researchers. You can read more about this in an article called Optical Imaging Monitors Brain Blood Flow in Children with Sickle Cell Disease. Thanks, Tammy. Now I'm joined by Mateen Durrani to talk about what it's like to give and receive a Nobel Prize.
Hi, Hamish.
Hi, Mateen. Now, you've interviewed my compatriot, Donna Strickland, who shared last year's Physics Nobel for inventing a technique for making very powerful laser pulses. What were some of her top tips for dealing with the instant fame of becoming a Nobel laureate?
Well, in Donna Strickland's case, she's a physicist at the University of Waterloo, which I don't think, Hamish, you can correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think had ever won a Nobel Prize before she did last year.
I think she's the first.
She's the first. Yeah. So, of course, for the University of Waterloo in Canada, that was, you know, a big deal. And immediately she had assembled around her a really good media team to handle all the deluge of inquiries and questions and demands on her time. So I think if you do win a Nobel Prize, you need to have a sort of group of experts who are knowledgeable at handling media inquiries in particular, and handling your diary, handling your timetable, because, you know, there's probably, I've never won a prize, but I imagine it comes thick and fast.
So I'm guessing, being from Physics World, you were put straight to the top of the queue with Strickland, or did it work, let's say, when you interacted with these people?
Well, it's quite, in this case, the interview grew out of the fact that Donna Strickland did a lecture at the Institute of Physics in London, and it was aimed squarely at sixth form students, so the next generation of scientists.
So there's a 17, 18-year-olds.
Exactly, 17, 18-year-olds, which was great, rather than speaking to people who are, you know, hardcore scientists. So it must be really inspiring. This was back in February. And afterwards, there was a drinks reception when I chatted to her. And luckily, I got the contact name of her media team. And it was through them that they very kindly set up the interview a couple of weeks ago.
And is she a celebrity in Waterloo? Would, you know, for example, my niece or nephew who live in Waterloo, would they recognize her in the streets and ask for her autograph?
Well, I did ask her that. And she said, no, it's quite rare that she's spotted in the street, although there's a big picture of her on campus, so sometimes people do recognize who she is.
And she's done some interesting things. I think she opened a pier in Germany. Is that I'm guessing that's at Lindau.
Yeah, she was now she's on this Nobel circuit. Having won the Nobel Prize, she's on the regular guest list for the Lindau conference, which I know you've been to, Hamish, in Germany, where Nobel laureates from around the world get invited every year to talk to up-and-coming students. And so she was at the event last summer in Lindau, and I asked her what was the sort of strangest thing that had happened to her this year, and she said it was opening a pier. So she opened a pier onto this lake, and you can see online pictures of her standing there on this pier. So that was the most unusual thing that she'd had to do. But, you know, she's had lots of speaking engagements. I think you're really in demand as a Nobel laureate.
But she still has her lab in Waterloo, and she's an active researcher. How has all this Nobel fame affected her research group? I'm guessing she's getting lots of money and lots of students, or maybe not. Are people hesitant to approach a laureate to do a PhD?
Well, I think for Donna Strickland, you know, the research is still the key for her. And she said in the interview that, yeah, it has been easier for her to get more money. But she did say that she didn't think that more students are contacting her because of that. Maybe they're too in awe of her, I don't know. But certainly getting the money from the funding agencies, she says that has been easier. But I remember when I met her in London earlier this year, you know, she was very approachable. So any students listening out there, you know, I would recommend getting in touch because, you know, she really, the laser physics is the key to what she's, who she is. And, you know, that's her passion.
Mm. And it's a great university, Waterloo. Can I put a little plug in for the university? Of course, it's in the same city as the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. And it also has a fantastic quantum information center. So yeah, if you're looking to do a PhD, you couldn't do worse than, or you couldn't do worse. What am I saying now? It's a good place to go. Yeah, definitely Waterloo.
Hang on, you're not getting paid for this, Hamish, are you? No money's changed hands.
No, yeah, no.
I've been there as well. I think when the Perimeter Institute had an anniversary, I went up to the campus, and yeah, it's, you know, great place. Lots going on there. So yeah, well done to Donna last year getting that prize.
And I was chuffed with the subtitle on the article. I think it's From Guelph to Stockholm. And I'm, you know, probably one of the few Physics World readers who actually knows how to pronounce Guelph properly. That's where Donna Strickland, it's the next town over from Waterloo.
Hang on, how do I pronounce it? Guelph.
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 Guelph. It's Guelph. It's actually the name of an Italian royal family from the Renaissance. So there's a very long and complicated story how a town
in Ontario.
We'll
discuss that off air, Hamish.
But yeah, that's great. I was, you know, over the moon when I heard that a fellow Canadian had won the Nobel Prize, and I'm sure many more will. So yeah, you can read Mateen's interview with Donna Strickland on the website. Just look for an article that's called Life as a New Nobel Laureate.
And Hamish, that's not the only Nobel stuff we've had. I mean, you've mentioned some of the other stuff, but there's the article that you did an interview with Lars Brink.
Yeah, I did an interview with Lars. He's a Swedish theoretical physicist. And on 8 separate occasions, he served on the Nobel Committee for Physics. And that's, I mean, it's not right to say that it's the committee that actually chooses the winner. But it's the committee that sort of makes the recommendation that's almost always followed by the Royal Swedish Academy, I think it's called. And it was based on a conversation that I had with Lars when I was in Birmingham a few months ago. And I recorded it, hoping to broadcast it, but unfortunately made the schoolboy error of doing it outside on a windy day. So it was not broadcast quality, but certainly a very good interview nonetheless. And so I turned that into a written piece. It is a fantastic article, if I do say so myself. I suppose I did write it. But it was very interesting to hear from Lars, sort of a personal perspective on, the one thing that really, really struck me is how much work goes into deciding who wins a Nobel Prize. I mean, you know, the process actually takes longer than a year. It's sort of 1 month longer than a year for each prize. And
they have hundreds of nominations, and there's quite a rigorous process of analysing and creating a shortlist and identifying, particularly in fields where there's lots of people which three people, and it can only be up to three people. And that's increasingly a hard problem these days, working out who the right people are. And they put a lot of effort into it. So it's not something they just decide at a whim. A lot of detailed work. And
not at all. I mean, I think that's something that, one thing that I got speaking to Lars was, you know, this three-body problem. It does make it very difficult. That incredible amount of work has to go into making sure that you've got everybody associated with a major breakthrough, but you can't have more than three people. I think Lars, I got the idea from him that was one of the most difficult things that that they had to do. And it's an incredible amount of work. They often get in external experts to write reports on topics that the committee members are not particularly familiar with. very interesting article, definitely.
And he talks about that that hot list that they have, where they sort of write, external referees write reports about people who've been nominated each year, and they have this each year. Even if someone's been nominated and is on a shortlist in the past, they get a new report created on them, and it's kind of this hot list is a sort of bubbling under list of potential prize winners. So that was a sort of inside story that I'd not seen mentioned before in the article.
Yeah, and one thing, you know, Lars mentioned is that this is an incredible wealth of material that is being produced on, you know, the history of physics and the how the ideas in physics evolve. And of course, you know, when a prize is announced, there is a scientific report that's released to the public, which is, you know, very valuable to journalists and, well, anybody who's interested in physics. But the other thing is that, you know, there's all these people who didn't win, and there's these reports written about them. Now, I think there's a 50-year rule.
50-year embargo. But what's really interesting, Hamish, is that I found that even though you can't find out any information about prizes that have been awarded within the last 50 years, for ones older than that, you can go online and search the Nobel database for reports on people. And that's very interesting. I didn't know that. I had not seen that before until me and you were working on this article. And that's really interesting. And you can see people who had won the prize and people who hadn't and what reports were given to them. So that's, you know, incredibly valuable historical resource. And of course, the work people do now will be of benefit to historians in 50 years' time.
Mm. And I mean, it's, you know, Lars is retired, I think. You know, he's worked on this for a long time. And, you know, basically he was saying that he's happy to get his summers back. Because, that was the time when they really put a lot of effort into deciding prizes. And I know, I sort of exchanged emails with Lars over this summer, and, you know, he was very happy to tell me that he was at his country house on the west coast of Sweden, where I'm sure it was very lovely, and, you know, wasn't reading and writing reports about particle physics. But it's a really interesting article to read. And if you want to know why sometimes there's a little bit of a delay before they make the announcement on the Tuesday morning, read the article, because Lars will provide a bit of insight into that. I really enjoyed meeting Lars and writing that article.
So what's the name of the article? Where can people find that?
So the article is called Inside the Nobels, Lars Brink Reveals How the World's Top Physics Prize is Awarded.
So the thing, Hamish, last week's podcast, we talked about an infographic that you made about showing how important migration was for the Nobel Prize winners, and that migration, scientists moving from one country to the next, was really important. But you've got another infographic that you've made, Hamish, about dividing all the prize winners in physics into different categories. And do you want to remind listeners what that's all about?
Yeah, this is, we first published this infographic in 2014, and we've just updated it to add, the latest Nobel Prizes. And what we've done is we've sort of divided physics, you know, I know this is arbitrary, we divided it up into seven categories. So we've got, you know, sort of astronomy, astrophysics, cosmology, that's one, nuclear and particle physics, condensed matter physics, quantum physics, and a few more, you know, applied physics, classical physics. And we've sort of looked at, a timeline of when the prizes are awarded to see if, there's any patterns. And of course, if you look at anything long enough, you can see patterns. But it is interesting when you look at our timeline. I should say that it's available online. You can have a look at it. You notice that there are, sort of maybe 5 to 9 year gaps between prizes in specific subject areas. And so we thought, could you use this to predict what the next prize was going to be? You know, for example, if we had looked at this infographic last year, we would have noticed that there was over 10 year gap between the last optics award And so, you know, it would have been very tempting last year to predict an optics Nobel Prize based on the fact that there hadn't been one in a long time.
So I'm just looking at the infographics. You've got one going to atomic molecular and optical physics in 2005. And
roughly.
I think that was the frequency comb stuff.
Right.
And yeah, then yeah, obviously last year you had optical tweezers and ultrafast optics.
That's right. Yeah.
So
yeah,
that was a 9-year gap.
Yeah.
So hang on. So 2008, can we do another 9-year gap? Does that work?
Well, the biggest gap that exists at the moment, well, I mean, if you discount classical physics, the biggest gap that exists on the moment is the gap from 2010. That's for quantum physics. And so there hasn't been a quantum physics award for, well, eight or nine years now. And so that is my prediction.
So you reckon a bit of quantum, so who's going to get that? What's your prediction?
Well
Anton Zeilinger?
Yeah, Anton Zeilinger is definitely on the list. I've done a blog about this called Our Pseudo-Scientific Picks for next week's Nobel Prize, because, you know, we've thought about this, but I hasten to add that...
Not as much as Lars Brinks thought about it.
Yeah, exactly. I hasten to add that this is really just...
It's like predicting an exam question, Hamish, isn't it, from the past papers?
Well, yeah.
Trying to work out who's next.
It is a bit of fun, and, you know, it will be interesting to see if we actually get this correct. But, I had a chat with Michael Banks, my colleague on News, and we came up with our number one pick is Alain Aspect, John Clauser, and Anton Zeilinger, and we think that they're going to win a prize for their work on testing Bell's inequality.
Wow. I mean, that's been one that everyone's thought about for quite some time because it's quite profound and also an experimental tour de force and something that's been in the news a lot recently.
Exactly, yeah. And the other thing is that back in 2010, the trio bagged the Wolf Prize in physics.
Ooh.
And it's amazing how many Wolf laureates
go on to win the Nobel Prize.
Mm. Yeah, but you know, if for some for some reason they don't win, we've got a few alternatives. Our second pick is Peter Shor, Gilles Bressard, and Charles Bennett. And we think, well, possibly Bressard and Bennett could share half of the prize for developing quantum cryptography. And then Peter Shor would get the other half for his eponymous factoring algorithm for quantum computing. And I should point out that this would be great news for Canada because Bressard is from Montreal. And so that would be two Nobel Prizes in a row for Canada. One from English Canada, one from French Canada. You couldn't ask for more. So yeah, that's another one that we've got in our sights.
English Canada, is that a thing?
Oh yeah, yeah.
English, not British.
No.
English Canada.
English Canada.
English speaking.
Yeah. English speaking Canada. Right, okay. Yeah. And French speaking Canada. Yeah. So another possibility, another favorite. Is an award to Peter Zoller and Ignacio Sirac for contributions to the development of processing quantum information. And this is an interesting pick because they published a groundbreaking paper in 1995 that described how a quantum computer could be implemented using cold trapped atoms. And this paper inspired David Wineland to build such a device, and he's actually won a Nobel Prize in part for doing that.
All right, okay.
So this
is that in the wrong way around, though, perhaps?
Well, possibly, but you know, they should definitely, you know, I think that they're definitely in with a chance on that. And I should say that you know, this list is obviously incomplete, but of course, as soon as I put it up, people pointed out that I had neglected David Deutsch. Who is also a real pioneer in terms of quantum information. And he, of course, would fit right in with Zoller and Sirac, for example. So, yeah, that's where we're going.
So I'm just looking at your infographic, Hamish. I mean, you said the last prize in classical physics was 1995. 70?
Mm.
So who did that go to?
Yeah, so that went to Hannes Alfvén for work on magnetohydrodynamics and plasma physics. And I think we've got, do we have Alfvén waves, which exist in the ionosphere, possibly named after him?
So that was one of the rare occasions, Hamish, when the prize was divided into two quite distinct fields. So on your infographic, you've kind of got one line going to one field and one to the other field from that year. But that was coming up to 50 years ago. So next year we'd be able to work out why that prize was awarded once the Nobel archives are open, because that'll be 1970, will be 50 years ago.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah. Because right. that prize went to is it Nail or Neil?
Yeah.
Nail. Louis Nail.
He won the other half, yeah. Yeah.
For his work on magnetism.
That's right.
Yeah.
So that was a quite unusual prize that it was sort of split between two quite different fields. But yeah, one thing we were saying before, Hamish, it's harder and harder to, you know, get the prize down to just the three people. And we were talking about quantum mechanics. I mean, that's going to be quite hard work to work out who takes precedent, who should win the prize if it is quantum physics.
Yeah.
Who wins it? It's a tough call.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't envy those people on the committee. It's a difficult job.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, that's definitely the overall impression that I got from Lars Brink. About, you know, just how tough it was and how much hard work it was. But, you know, he also said it was very rewarding. But, you know, one thing that I think about, you know, the Nobel Prize is that unlike other, you know, maybe bigger money prizes that do exist these days, the Nobel Prize is unique in that it can be a complete surprise. So on Tuesday, you know, when the announcement is made in Stockholm, you know, it could be something completely left field, you know, maybe some work that was done decades ago that, you know, is really important, but people have forgotten about. Or, and then, you know, there's things like, you know, blue LEDs, for example. You wouldn't, of course it's physics, but, you know, you wouldn't really think that it, you think of it as engineering. And so when that prize is announced, you're surprised. Well, yes, of course, blue LEDs, incredibly important. But, you know, I wasn't sort of thinking in that way. So, yeah, it's a great prize. It's, you know, I think it's much more interesting than other prizes, which tend to be much more predictable.
Yeah, some prizes more what's flavor of the month or who the committee knows. And I think the Nobel Prize, because of the amount of work that they do in picking the winners, you know, is fairly reliable. And I think even Lars Brink said in that article that he thinks they've very rarely made a mistake.
Yeah.
Not at all, I think, was what he said. You know, who they give it to is probably, for want of a better word, the correct person.
Yeah.
Or people.
And that's something that, you know, we published the article, I think it was yesterday or sometime this week. And some of the comments that were coming up on Twitter, you know, people agreeing with Brink that, yes, there have been very few, if any, mistakes made by the committee. So, you know, we can thank Lars Brink and all his colleagues for, you know, really putting an incredible effort into it. Okay, thanks, Mateen.
Thanks. And I think we've run out of time, so you can't ask me who I think is going to win because I don't know. I think all my predictions have always been wrong, so not going to make one this year.
Now I'm joined by Tushna Commissariat to talk about a very popular article on the website by one of our regular freelance contributors. Hi, Tushna.
Hi, Hamish.
Now, this story has a really interesting background. I got in touch with a freelancer, that's Louisa Cockbill, a while ago to see if she could write a news article for us. But she declined because she was busy taking a giant inflatable explorer dome around schools in southwest England and talking to children about science. So I think I got in touch with you, Tushna, and I thought this might make an interesting career story, because, you know, what a career that is, you know, taking a dome around to schools and talking to children. But the article that came back from Louisa was really, really funny, wasn't it? So
yeah,
what did you decide to do with it then?
So yeah, I think what she kind of, you know, initially we thought it could be like a careers piece, but you know, Louisa does quite a few things, like also science writing in that, she wrote mainly about what it's like using this as a science communication tool, this giant dome. And yeah, it was really funny what it's like dealing with school children stuffed into this inflatable dome. And we thought it was a brilliantly funny piece to put in the lateral thoughts column, which is the back page of Physics World, and populated by readers, and anyone can write in, and about 900 words on something that's vaguely physics related and also humorous. So that's where her column finally went, and it was a really good lateral thoughts piece, very lateral and very thinky.
And you can, it's online. You can you can read the piece. It's called "The Universe Under a Dome," and it's been very popular. And I think one of the reasons, and you know, I really enjoyed her characterizations of the children that she comes across inside the dome when she goes from school to school.
Yeah.
You know, for example, there's always one who's eyeing it up as a potential bouncy castle.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm guessing has to be held back from throwing themselves into the wall. But, I mean, I was definitely the child who swallowed an encyclopedia, as Louisa describes one type of child that she comes across. Did you recognize a young Tushner in any of those children?
I did. I very much did. And in fact, I remember laughing when I first read that and thinking, gosh, this is probably every Physics World reader going to make that generalization. Because definitely I could imagine everyone on our team having a, you know, space book when you were younger. And sort of reading it up and having all those facts to throw out and then getting really excited, you know, when you're at a talk like this and you just want to be like, ooh, me, I know that.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, when I read the article, I was immediately transported back to my childhood. And, you know, just thinking how incredibly happy I would have been if somebody turned up at my school, you know, and sort of pumped up the Explorer Dome in the school gym. You know, I would have thought, yes, you know, this is for me, finally.
Exactly.
You know, something for me. You know, I just would have been over the moon.
Uh-huh.
I mean, let's be honest, I'm in my 50s, and back when I was at school, you know, there was nothing like this, really. I mean, our teachers were great, you know, we learned lots of things, but we didn't really have, you know, people coming to our school with inflatable domes
and that sort of thing.
So how about you, Tushar?
No, I can't say, unfortunately, like, you know, even though I was in a good school in Bombay in India, we didn't have anything quite like that. But I do remember the handful of times that we had a school trip to the Nehru Planetarium in Bombay, which is, I think, one of the biggest planetariums in India, if not the biggest. You know, and it's in a really nice part of Bombay, and it was very exciting. And I used to get, you know, they even have these, like, they have these little rooms, these tiny little, like, it's like the size of a cupboard, where you can go and stand, and it tells you what your weight would be on Mars or on Jupiter. And I used to love going into those rooms and being like, ooh, you know. And yeah, so that was like the closest I got to anything like that in school, would have been going to the planetarium. And funny, I'm in fact going to the planetarium in Bristol tomorrow evening with Andrew Glester and the rest of the Cosmic Shed gang, because there is a new planetarium show called Life in the Universe, and it's in 3D in Bristol Planetarium.
Fantastic. So, Andrew, of course, does our monthly podcast.
Exactly.
Yeah. I have a similar memory of, you know, going to the Ontario Science Centre in Toronto, which, you know, at the time was a sort of cutting edge center for learning about science. And they used to have a, well, they still do, I think, a Van de Graaff generator.
Oh, nice.
And the idea was that, you know, you could go and touch the Van de Graaff generator and your hair would go out like that. You know, not that I really have much hair these days, but, you know, I remember sort of sitting in the auditorium as a child and watching this display of somebody with very long hair touching it and their hair going out in all directions. And then years and years later, I took my children to the Ontario Science Centre. And there it was, the Van de Graaff generator for anybody. Anybody could go up and touch it, right?
Nice.
And so my daughter, who had very long hair at the time, went up and touched it, and nothing happened.
Oh, no.
And the problem was that we were there in the height of the sort of hot and humid Ontario summer, and there was just too much humidity in the building for, you know, the static, you know, for the potential to build up.
So
I have to say that was a bit of a downer. But I mean, Louise's article is really funny. She's got some fantastic characterizations of children and the questions that they ask. One of the children asked, what happens when two black holes collide,
indeed,
for example, you know, what a great question.
And we can tell them now, can't we?
We
can
certainly
tell them all
can.
About it.
Yeah. So, you know, if you read this article, you know, I guarantee it'll bring back some great memories of childhood, and, you know, when you were really curious about physics and science in general. And it's called Universe Under a Dome by Louisa Cockbill.
That's right. Yeah.
Well, that's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Tushna Commissariat, Mateen Durrani, and Tammy Freeman for joining me. And of course, a special thank you to our producer, Callum Jelf. And remember, if you like what you hear, then you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. And we're also available now on Spotify, so you can follow us there. Thanks for listening. And please do join us again next week when we will know who has won the Nobel Prize for Physics, and we'll be chatting about that, amongst other things. Bye.
Physics World.